Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello again, and welcome to the best of My Time Capsule 2021. Part three. Yes, part three. So that's 3 hours of best bits. But then again, we have released almost 100 episodes this year, so there's a lot to choose from. If you've rather strangely decided that this is the first episode of this podcast that you're going to listen to, I ought to tell you the premise. I'm Mike Fenton Stevens, and I talk to my guest about five things from their life that they would choose to preserve in a time capsule. Four things they love and one thing they loathe. That's it. A simple idea with, it would seem, an endless number of results. It seems that finally, at the age of 63, I've had a good idea. Anyway, let's waste no more time with my life story and dive straight in with our first extract. And this is from a recent episode which we released in November with the presenter of, among other things, the TV show DIY SOS, Nick Knowles. Here he is talking about his dad.
Odd enough, one would be a golf ball with EK on it. So these are my father's initials. So my father was kind of my hero. He was quite old when he had me, and I'm getting quite old now anyway. But anyway, he flew Hurricanes at the end of the Second World War. He was ground crew RAF. Then when they were running out of pilots, they made him a flight sergeant, or he actually went to Rhodesia, as he used to call it all the time, Zimbabwe, to do his training. And then ended up on a troop ship out to Egypt at the end of the war, where he met my mum, and they got married in Cairo. And he was flying Hurricanes over there in Egypt and Palestine and around that part of the world at the end of the Second World War. But he said that they used to get up in their pyjamas and couldn't be bothered to get dressed when they actually had an early morning flight. So they'd basically put the parachute on. And then in the training planes, they used to clip their parachute into the seat. Because you do all your harness up and that holds you in the seat. And you used to clip the parachute into the seat. And that's what held you in the seat. You'd unclip that if you needed to get out. And it was a two-seater, and the guy in front was doing some training, and he was basically just there to observe. So he hadn't bothered. He just, like, slung it over his shoulders and clipped it in. So he pulled the hood over because he was going to do some night flying. So he used to pull a hood over, and he went, yeah, fine. My dad's job was just to sort of spot. And after a little while, he pulled the hood back, and he said, I'm just going to try and do some sort of manoeuvres whilst night flying, you know, flip the plane about a bit and get myself back. And he said, yeah, all right. So the guy pulled the hood back and then flipped the plane upside down. Now, the difficulty was my dad's parachute was clipped into the seat, but he hadn't done the straps up. So the parachute started to fall off his shoulders. He grabbed his lapels and was starting to rip his own lapels. He was trying to kick the back of the seat because basically, if he fell out, he was going out without his parachute.
Oh, my God.
And he said just at the last minute when his fingernails were like just about to pop off, the guy flipped the plane back over and... but he didn't unclench his buttocks for about a month after that, so...
I hadn't met Nick Knowles before we chatted. What a delightful man he is. In August, I spoke to the actor and stand-up comedian Omid Jalili, who's had the most extraordinary career. And I was very pleased that he spoke about working on one of my favourite films, Gladiator.
As far as career highlights, I think
everyone says great films you've done. And yeah, it was really great to be in wonderful films, life-changing films, actually. When I remember telling a friend of mine, a comedian called Andre Vincent, he kept saying, "You're in Gladiator in the film." I said, "Andre, I'm only in it for 3 or 4 minutes. He goes, "It's 3 or 4 minutes more than I'm in it."
It's true.
And that's such a perfect comedian's answer. And I think that when you're on these big movies, it does impact you in the sense you see the scale of it. I'll never forget the very first day was my point of view as a camera. So I'm behind the camera and I say, "Proxima, my old friend." And there's a camera pushing on Oliver Reed, who's there, and he looks. It's just that's my first day of shooting. It's the first thing I did, a camera pushing, saying my lines, as they say, speak to Oliver Reed. And it was meant to be in this AD 180 cafe, and there's smoke and there's action. It's so packed. And I thought, what an amazing scene. No wonder this guy, Ridley Scott, it's such a rich, and I was looking at it. He said, "Come and watch." So I was watching the camera. Then he went, "Cut." And I never forget, he got his cigar out. He goes, "We've got a second of dead time. I need a dog or a little person." And then out of nowhere, they brought this very small person and a dog. He goes, "Yeah, could you two wipe it?" And then he goes, "Okay, let's reposition, action." We did the same thing, Proxima, my old friend. We go in there, and at the back of the scene, you just see a dog and a small person. And he went, "Okay, got it." We moved on.
Wow.
That was the level in which, because I said to him, "Ridley, why are you, like, you got a marketplace, like there's 5,000 extras here and there's like 100 oranges, but the camera, you're only picking up 2 or 3 oranges." And he just said, "The camera never lies. There's something about packing a shot. If you pack it, it affects the scene. If you lie, it knows. And even in the edit, you'll see there's a bit of dead time there, or there's a blank there where there should have been oranges. But the camera really will pick up the richness if you pack the shot full." So that was an amazing experience to see.
And the last work that Oliver Reed did.
Yes. Did you ever work with Oliver Reed?
No, never did, sadly. I did meet him once.
What was he like?
He was a bit drunk.
Well, that's the thing. Apparently he'd signed a contract not to drink on Gladiator because nobody wanted him. But Ridley Scott said, "He's my man and I have to have him." So he had to sign these waivers that he'll be teetotal 4 months before. He'll be teetotal all throughout. Of course, you spend time, 95% of this business sitting around like us. This could be a film set where you and I are just chatting away. And then they'll say, "Okay, Michael and Ami, do you think, oh, for fuck's sake, we're chatting here."
In the middle of an anecdote.
In the middle of an anecdote. Don't ever interrupt me in the middle of an anecdote. And he was very gracious. And I said to him, I was a bit nervous about meeting. I stayed in the hotel. He goes, "Oh, no, that's all nonsense." He goes, "I do like a drink and I've stopped and it's all nonsense because I'm taking my career seriously." He's about 67 at the time. And he was very generous with his time. He talked to me. We chatted the whole 3 days. We were together. And he'd sit and tell me his life story. And it was very sad the way he died, actually. Everyone says it's the way he wanted to go, but actually he didn't. He was challenged to a drinking competition. And he got alcohol poisoning very quickly and died. And it was such a shame because the press narrative was that that's the way he wanted to go. But actually, it was devastating for the film. He never finished his scenes. And by the way, when I read Gladiator as a script, the ending is profoundly moving because it's him. He comes down and picks up Russell Crowe's character and gives this massive speech about the end of Rome and that the spirit of this centurion will go on. But Rome is over, you're morally corrupt, and I'm going to give this guy a hero's burial. And he lifts his body up above his head and he walks him out to silence.
Oh.
It's meant to be totally silent. So he's, I don't know how many people are meant to be there, 20,000, 30,000 people go silent. And it was very moving, but they couldn't do that. People were devastated that he never finished what was in the script.
For something that really, to many people, is fundamentally a perfect film, I think, Gladiator. You describing that ending makes us realise it's not.
It's not the perfect film at all.
That would have been extraordinary. Yeah, that's quite an insight into the making of that film. My next guest was also in an iconic film, 4 Weddings and a Funeral, where she played the rather unflatteringly named character, Duckface. Here is Anna Chancellor talking about how, despite her excellent good looks, she got the role.
And amazingly, then I got this Boddington's beer commercial, which was quite sort of a hit at the time. They were popular commercials at the time. This was a takeoff of a Cornetto advert. And then 4 Weddings and a Funeral came quite quickly off the back of that. Although I know that when they interviewed me I think they might have thought I was a bit of a loose cannon. But I had had this love affair with this terrible, semi-dangerous guy. Oh, and he had bought me a pair of Manolo Blahnik shoes, which were very expensive and made out of black velvet. And Mike Newell, at the time, they noticed these. Anyway, they were captured by these shoes. They were captivated by, I think it was between me and another girl, but they were like, let's bring her back and see if she's got those shoes on. That's what Mike told me recently.
Wow.
I was lucky. Just at that time, I had something in me that those guys kind of found like a little bit nutty or something, because Duckface was a bit of a nutter.
Yeah. And they didn't want someone to act it.
They probably were going for a little bit of reality there because I had no experience. They took a punt with me, I suppose.
Well, they did. With everybody in that film. You can look at it now and say, full of famous people, but hardly anybody at the time. Simon Callow, I think, possibly. Yeah. Everybody else, not famous.
Yeah.
There was not a person in it that anybody had heard of, even Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
And then after the film went out, everybody in it was famous.
Yeah.
So the punt was there all the way along.
Yeah. No, it was a bit like you were dreaming.
Mm.
But I remember at the time Hugh saying to me, they think this might be successful like a fish called Wanda. I was like, do you really think so? He said, but I think it's awful, just so unbelievable, all his awful friends. It's so, I can't remember. He's always very critical in a very funny way of absolutely everything.
Yeah, and almost everything he's ever done.
Yeah.
He talks about it as if it's rubbish.
Yeah, that's a defence, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, I've never known anybody who could do Richard Curtis better than Richard Curtis, apart from Hugh Grant.
Next, in episode 98, I talk to the star of the TV quiz QI and the murder mystery series Jonathan Creek, Alan Davies. Alan had just released his sort of autobiography, so it was bound to come up. But what I really loved about talking to Alan was the rambling nature of it all.
And I said right at the beginning of publishing my book, which I've tried to make, it's not a misery memoir. I've tried to keep humour there. It's not about self-pity. It's not about vengeance. It's about telling a story that's been really bugging me. Yeah. And I wanted it to be, from the beginning, something that if one person felt better for it, helped by it, helped, like somebody had reached a hand out, and they were able to say, oh, wow, somebody's like, I'm not the only one, then I've done what I set out to do. So that's where I've been. It took me a long time to write. I worked on the book doing a master's at Goldsmiths College, mm-hmm. Where I went to try and improve as a writer and to study the craft and to be a student again anyway. And I never really knew if I would publish something at the end of that time. It was a 2-year part-time course that I did between 2016 and 2018. But I loved going there on a Wednesday. I loved being a student. I liked every bit of it. I liked going in the library. I liked the fact that I say 3 out of 10 library cards don't open the gate. I liked all the guys on the reception. I liked all of my tutors were fantastically educational, yeah, and inspiring. I made lots of friends amongst the other students. I liked going to the pub and I loved it. I heartily recommend. I remember Frank Skinner saying, as a colleague of mine, we've been doing stand-up similar length of time, we've known each other a very long time. But I remember him saying once, lessons are good. And just as a motto, as a mantra, I thought it was a very wise thing to say.
That's great.
Lessons are good. Yeah. And if you're always having lessons in something, he said, it doesn't matter what it is. He's a former teacher, as you may know. But if it's golf or piano or Swahili or writing or knitting or basket weaving, it doesn't matter. But if you're having lessons in something, there's a notion of self-improvement, of achievement, of progress, of being the opposite of stagnant. And I think it's a wise motto.
I had that conversation with my grandson this very morning.
Oh, really?
Yes, he has this habit. He's got an iPad, and he tends to ring me. Well, he FaceTimes me at about 8:30 every morning.
Oh, that's nice.
Without anybody knowing. It's really lovely. The thing goes, and I go, oh, hiya, Freddie. And then we chat, and he gets under his covers so that his dad doesn't know he's doing it.
Oh, what age is Freddie?
Say 6.
Oh, nice.
We were talking about the fact that he had to do his schoolwork, and I was saying, have you got English today? And he said, yes. I said, it's great English, isn't it? Because there's so many words. I mean, even if you spent all your life trying to learn them all, you'd never learn all of them. And he said, oh. And I said, well, don't be put off by that, Freddie. What's the point then if I can't learn them all? And so should we say that this is the first item in your time capsule, your book?
Yes, let's. It might seem like an act of vanity or of all the things in the world that you could choose. You choose your own book about your life. And in some ways, it's, you know, all comedians have there's a hell of an ego, for better or worse. It's part of the job. You have to have it, otherwise why in a room of 1,000 people do you think you should be the one with the microphone? That is the mindset. It's fine, everyone, don't worry, I'll do the talking. You all sit there, look at me, and at the end, adulation. I can handle any amount of adulation. So it is a peculiar job to do, and there is an ego there, but it is a wonderful thing to have an aptitude for, and the sound of laughter, and it's just a joy when a stand-up gig is going well and you're happy up there and the audience are enjoying it.
Right, this next snippet is from a guest that got a really lovely reaction from our listeners, despite being not famous at all. He's lived and continues to live, I'm glad to say, the most extraordinary life. His name is Adam Wide, and here he is talking about his night with Freddie Mercury. Sounds like a film, doesn't it?
But Freddie, what a lovely, lovely, lovely man. And I was in the Copacabana, which is a gay bar in Elsport. And there's this chap, and I didn't recognise him at all. I had no idea. I just thought he was quite handsome, charismatic, yes. Had a twinkle. And he was standing across the... And there was kind of no one in there. It was, I think, a Tuesday evening or something. And he was with a big burly bloke who came over and said, Freddie fancies you. I said, he's only over there and I'm here. It's not very far to walk, is it? So he went back. Obviously, said Freddie, he says he's just over there. So he came over, you know, smiling and chuckling. I had not a clue who he was, not a hint of an idea who he was.
Now, you were not interested in that sort of music, were
no,
you?
No, not at all. I was 1940s dance band.
Yes.
You know, I didn't know who this chap was. I hadn't got a clue.
Yeah, if it was Al Jolson, he would have been straight out of my car.
Exactly. So push comes to shove and we go back to his place. And do you know what was amazing? Was I still didn't have a clue, and we were downstairs and we were talking, and there's a Sotheby's catalogue for Lalique glass on his downstairs sort of den coffee table. And the fact that we'd gone down outside the house, his posh house in Holland Park, and we'd gone not up the front door to the steps, we went round the side and down, and I thought, perhaps he works here. Perhaps he's the chauffeur. Yeah. You know, what's going on? And there's this big Lalique book on the coffee table. And I said, oh, I love Lalique. And I was looking at him. He said, really? Come with me. And he took me upstairs from the basement. And it was then, as we went up from the stairs, there were all these gold and platinum discs on the wall. Yes. Saying, Queen, 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 Queen. And then some of them had pictures of him. Jeez. And I went, oh, right.
I remember
Queen,
who you are now.
Yes. And anyway, he took me up to the top of the stairs. He turned left. We went into a room and he flicked a switch. And it was like being in a museum for Lalique. And there were cabinet upon cabinet of fabulous, fabulous glass. And he was super knowledgeable. And he took me around. We must have spent an hour in that room just looking at Lalique before we did the deed. I mean, it's just fantastic. Anyway, the next morning he said, come out, and we're filming at Pinewood. Come and, you know, it would be fabulous to have you out there. I said, well, no, I've got to go to work. He said, no, but we're doing this thing, Radio Gaga. It'd be fab if you were in the audience. It'd be brilliant. And he gave me his phone number, and I went to work, and I said, oh, I had a funny night with this chap, Freddie Mercury. They went, what? You didn't watch? What? And then I realised how massive he was.
Yes.
And by then, I could never phone that number because suddenly it would look like I was craven. And I was then super embarrassed that I didn't know who he was or how massive he was. So I never, ever phoned that number. Who knows what might have happened?
Our next guest is the actor Paul Bradley, famous for his roles as Nigel in EastEnders and Elliot Hope in Holby City. Now, there have been some extraordinary stories on My Time Capsule throughout the year, but probably none as shocking as the one Paul told me about his trip to Rwanda on behalf of Comic Relief. I remember you going off to Rwanda, and I remember at the time thinking, oh my word, this will absolutely change your life.
Yes, it did. And if it hadn't, and I wasn't really going to get onto it because it's terribly heavy, but if it hadn't been for a woman who was there, she worked for Oxfam. She was an incredible woman. She lost, I think, 15 members of her family. She watched her husband being shot at a roadblock. And when we were sat down once, and I've kept it, I've got it in a drawer here. We were just talking like this, and she gasped and looked down, and she went, oh, my God. And I went, and she was unflappable, usually sort of like really. And I said, what is it? And she said, it's somebody's skull. And I looked down, and it wasn't. It was a piece of gourd, you know the gourd thing.
Yeah.
But the fact that she could think that, and actually where we'd sat, she had found somebody's knuckle. And one of the worst things that I remember, because I used to go off on my own and take photos. I took loads of photographs. And I was in this classroom where there'd been a massacre. And my foot was scraping along the floor. And I thought, oh, I've got a stone stuck in my boot, you know. So I sat down and I turned the boot round, and there were several teeth that I'd stood on. They were children's teeth.
Oh, Lord.
It was, and when I look back on it now, if it hadn't been for Esther, who took us on this journey, I think I would have gone a bit madder than I did.
Terrible. Anyway, I think we need to lighten the mood a bit. So here from episode 80 is the fantastic stand-up comedian, Ed Byrne.
Number two is definitely the most self-indulgent of my choices.
Good.
I'm going to put Camden Jonglers into the...
Oh, right.
Yeah, you know, which was a comedy club.
Mm-hmm.
And it was where I did my last ever open spot.
Ah.
You know, when you're doing five-minute slots.
Before you broke, really, as it were.
Yeah. And it was the last one I had to do. I had done open mic at everywhere else, and I was in at all the other clubs. Jonglers is one of those clubs that tends to get, was always sort of disparaged, but the Camden one was always just that little bit better. And it was actually, on a good night, it was a great club. I've had some fucking shockers there as well. I've gone on to nothing and left to less. But I've also had some amazing gigs there. It was the one that was the hardest one to get into. It was notorious for you have to do a lot of open spots. You have to do... You know, you go down, you do one on a Friday and then another one on a Saturday, and they keep you coming back. And then you do like a weekend of 10-minute spots until finally then you were in. And then once you were in, it was good money. So they had quite a – it was known for you had to sort of jump through hoops to get to be a regular there.
Yeah.
But on my third five-minute slot that I did there, it was like the final scene in a film about someone who wants to be a comedian. You know, it was unbelievable. You couldn't write it. I had at this stage my 5 minute, my open spot. It was about two subjects. It was about smoking and it was about drinking. And it was really tight. There wasn't an ounce of fat on it. And it was bam, bam, bam. It was kind of, in the 90s, it was invoked to be very sort of in your face, quite aggressive, fast talking. And it was all that. And it just killed. Even if I say so myself. And I went off, and I remember it was Tim Clark was hosting, and he really had to calm the audience down for the next act.
Brilliant.
They actually, I swear this is true, they started chanting, "We want Ed, we want Ed." I swear that happened. It wasn't a genius fucking routine. It was a good routine. It was tight. It was just very, very gag heavy. And for that room, that time, for that level of drunk, it just worked a treat.
Brilliant.
But they did. They started to chant, "We want Ed, we want Ed." And then I didn't know this until afterwards, but just at that moment, the owner of the club phoned up about something else, phoned box office, was speaking to the manager who was on duty that night and was asking him about something or other. and then just as in passing said, oh, and how did the open spot go? And the manager went to the bouncer, open that door. And you opened the door from the foyer into the main room, and the manager held the phone up to the audience chanting, we want Ed, we want Ed.
Oh, fantastic.
And he went, that's how it went. And he said, oh, I guess we better just put him straight onto Weekends then.
I'm sorry, but it's been written by Richard Curtis, that, isn't it? Surely.
Isn't it? Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Chris Lang, my guest in episode 79 of My Time Capsule, has had a number of careers. He was an actor and part of a comedy trio in the 1980s that had his mate Hugh Grant in it. But Chris eschewed fame and fortune. He just went for fortune as the writer and producer of some of the best dramas on TV, including the fabulous Unforgotten, starring Sanjeev Bhaskar, who will be a guest on My Time Capsule in 2022. But before the acting, writing and producing, Chris was in a band. Well, wasn't everybody? Yeah, not like this one.
The reason I chose drumsticks was because I can't think of anything that better reminds me and symbolises my youth and my growing up period in a small market town in Surrey.
So were you in a band?
I was, and it's an odd situation because I was in a band in a tiny little sleepy Surrey market town of Reigate. There were four of us. There was a guy who went on to become a journalist in France, and then the lead singer of our little band was Paul Heaton of the House Martins and the Beautiful South.
Yes.
And the bassist was Norman Cook or Fatboy Slim. And then me.
Oh, my God.
So that was our little band. And I found a photo the other day, which I did stick on Twitter as well. And it was a picture of us busking just outside the town hall of Reigate. And we busked a lot in our various school or student holidays. And we actually made really good money always. But there's a picture of us busking, and you can just see Paul and Norman, Fatboy. And there's me sort of sitting behind my drum kit, sort of staring up to space. And the sort of speech bubble sort of slightly reads, these guys are never going to make anything out of music. I'm off to RADA to be a film star. And the rest, obviously, as they say, is history.
It's history, because you did then do that ridiculous thing of leaving behind these losers. Obviously.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Then pairing up in a comedy team with other losers.
You know? With other absolute no-hopers.
No-hopers, you know.
Yeah.
You've been so wise to constantly move on from these people.
And I like to think at exactly the right moment, yes. Yeah. Just as they catapulted to international fame and huge fortune.
Yeah.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. when I said, no, not for me, thanks.
No. Could I ask, who are you writing with at the moment?
Who do I write with?
Yeah, because obviously they're going to be huge when you stop writing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm writing with Steven Spielberg. Yeah.
Okay, before we have a little ad break, let's hear from the stand-up comedian and host of BBC Radio 4's The News Quiz, among other things, the lovely Angela Barnes.
Now, originally I was going to say I want to put the Archers in there because I'm a lifelong fan of the Archers. I love the Archers. People don't expect that of me necessarily, but I was brought up listening to it with my mum, and I have to listen to the Archers every day. But I used to say it's like getting a 15-minute hug, and then somebody pointed out that actually a 15-minute hug's a bit creepy. So maybe not that. But then I thought, actually, no, it's not just the Archers, is it? It's everything around it. It's like I listen to the Archers, but then I leave the radio on and I listen to Front Row. And then, you know, obviously I listen to the comedy before the Archers, and I grew up listening to the News Quiz, and that's how I, you know, sort of got obsessed with comedy was through Radio 4. So I thought, no, it's the whole shebang. I want Radio 4 in the time capsule because I can't imagine my life without it.
That's perfect. But actually, the Archers and Radio 4 listening, I think, is often a thing that's inherited.
Mm.
You learn it from your parents. So was your mum an Archers listener, or is she?
Definitely. My mum, it makes me think of my mum in the kitchen sort of cooking dinner and the Archers would be on. And then I remember when I went off to university when I was 18, I would secretly listen to it because I used to, you know, I'd be like, oh, she's listening to the Archers, you know, moaning about it. And then when I went off to university, because when I went to university in the sort of mid-90s, the internet hadn't quite taken off yet. And, you know, we didn't have mobile phones and stuff. And so my sort of connection to home was to listen to The Archers every day. But I used to listen to it in secret. Like, there's no way I could tell my fellow students that I was sneaking off to listen to The Archers at 7 o'clock every night. But I would. I'd sit in my little room in halls with my little radio and listen to The Archers. And it was just my little connection to home.
Yeah, you know. Lovely.
And I remember I was in my 20s and I had this boyfriend who, it turned out, also listened to The Archers. And we were like, oh, it's our guilty secret. Like, we've got this. It's not just me. I thought I was the only person my age who listened to it. And then, of course, now with podcasts and the internet and everything else, you're like, oh, my God, everyone. There's a whole world of fandom for The Archers. Mm. And I love Archers fans because they're all bonkers, like all of them. We all love those characters. We get angry with the script writers. I just love the whole world of it.
I have to say, there was a period of my life where suddenly I became interesting to a group of women of a certain age. And they would basically ask me, they would say, do the voice. And it's because I played a character in The Archers.
Who did you play in The Archers?
I was Paul, Lillian's lover.
Lillian's Paul. You were Paul. Oh my goodness. No, I don't think I knew that. You were Lillian's Paul who died.
Yeah.
Well, wow. Oh, that's just. But you don't look like him.
No, I know. No, I'm so sorry to spoil it. I know. He's a big swarthy man, isn't he?
That is the thing with The Archers. I hate. Like, I quite often now get to, like, I do podcasts and things about The Archers, and I quite often get to meet the actors. Mm. And while it's really nice to meet them, it's always like, but you don't look like...
No.
You don't look like them. It's not right. They're in my head.
No, I know. Well, that's why people wanted me to do the voice, because I didn't look anything like Paul would look, because he was a builder. He was a big, strong, you know, gnarled hand man, the sort of man that some women have an idea it might be interesting to go to bed with.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of going to bed with Lillian.
Yes.
And they basically wanted me to just go deep and quiet and just be a bit sort of rough.
I had no idea that was you. That's so funny.
Aha, yes. The Archers. Did you know I was in that? You see, still waters run deep. And of course, if that's true, I'm a babbling brook. See you after the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to The Best of My Time Capsule Part 3 and our next little clip from Episode 108. Here's the DJ and TV presenter Nicky Campbell talking about his childhood obsession with the Loch Ness Monster.
When something gets legs, as it were, or flippers, you know, it really goes. And it was, of course, it was good business for the area, but I knew people. My aunts said they saw it. I had two twin aunts called Ethel and Beatrice, my dad's sisters, who till their dying days said that they saw it when they were girls. It's big, this hump going through the water. All right. There is no monster, but there's stuff. People see stuff.
There's the famous picture of the fin, isn't there?
Yeah, the Rhine's Egerton flipper photograph. Bob Rhines and Edgerton. Bob Rhines looked like a retired astronaut or a Democrat senator. He had that kind of look. And they got these images over, I think, a couple of years. And the first one was the Rhines-Edgerton flipper thing. Now, Sir Peter Scott got involved in it, David Attenborough. There's something in the air then. Anyway, when the flipper photograph came out, I thought, that's it. Hook, line, and sinker. That is the proof. At last, the zoological establishment can take this seriously, because I was forever worried that it was a dwindling population. There wouldn't be a viable breeding population. So there we were. A couple of years after that, their efforts to give it scientific credibility had foundered. And I found myself at a party, and it was like my dream was shattered as well. I really thought that would be the turning point. And I found myself at a party given by a man who owned stuff. It was on the hill, and it was a big 60s, 70s, massive glass window dream house on the hill looking over Loch Ness. And my dad knew him. He was called Gordon, and he was gay and had a boyfriend. And it was all very, at the time, my parents didn't give a shit. And I remember them not giving a shit about that. And there was a man there, and I realized that was Bob Rhines. And he wandered off on his own to the window. He was staring out the window, and I sort of trailed him, you know, surreptitiously. I sort of trailed him towards the window, and I was close enough, and I heard what he said. He looked out the window, he was looking onto the lock, and he went, "Where are you?"
Oh, that's Spielberg. Yeah. Wow, that's fantastic. In October, I spoke to the governess herself, star of the TV quiz show The Chase, Anne Hegarty. We covered lots of subjects, as you can imagine, with lots of facts in them, as you can also imagine. But as a grandfather with an autistic grandson, I really loved hearing about how she coped with her autism as a young girl. Not the way we do it now, obviously, but fascinating.
My first item is a school. It's Sheridswood School, which is where I went for 5 years. And in those days, it was two buildings. It's really only one building now, so you probably could get it into your time capsule quite readily.
Okay, yes. Where is it?
The original senior school that I was at was Welwyn Garden City. The boarding house was about 2 miles away in Old Welwyn. And the boarding house is still there, standing in 57 acres of grounds.
Wow.
With a little river running through it called the Mimram. The house used to be owned by sort of a succession of posh families, one of whom knew the tightrope walker Blondin, and he walked across Niagara Falls, and he used to practice over the Mimram, which is a really very small little river and has sort of, you know, the occasional very small weir that's about sort of 3 feet or something like that. And he used to practice his tightrope walks over there. But
not that you saw that, Anne.
Well, no, I'm not quite that old, by the way. like I say, before it was a school, it was an old sort of very small stately home. And it had one of those sort of sweeping wooden staircases that apparently was entirely made out of tulip wood and was worth about, in the 1970s, it had been estimated about £250,000, which is an awful lot of money in those days.
My God.
We weren't allowed to use it. On Saturday mornings, we all had to do a bit of housework. And I used to quite enjoy polishing the staircase.
So did you board there?
I did. In my early teens, people didn't actually know what autism was in those days, but I was sort of starting to, you know, it was becoming quite obvious that I was really struggling with the world generally. And my mother, being a psychiatric social worker, she knew that there were funds set aside for special needs education. And I mean, nobody knew what my special needs were, but they were fairly sure I must have some. So they managed to have me sent to a boarding school. And after the initial shock, which probably lasted about a year, I was sort of like, yeah, okay, this kind of actually all makes sense. And I learned a lot of sort of basic social skills that you kind of have to learn in those circumstances. Otherwise, people are just going to keep sticking your head down the loo and flushing it until you get a clue. I picked up on a lot of stuff quite quickly.
It's a cruel way to learn, though, isn't it? That's quite...
Well, yeah, okay, not quite like that.
No.
Yeah, but the thing is, there were certain things that I just simply did need to learn, and nobody had any other way of getting me to understand things like that. I still didn't know how to tie my shoelaces. I didn't learn how to tie my shoelaces until after I graduated from university. So, I mean, it is literally true. I got my master's degree before I learned to tie my shoelaces, which is really quite sort of typically absent-minded professor stroke autistic person thing.
Yeah.
One thing I did in primary school, because I realised that my primary school wasn't going to be any use in teaching me this, was learning a list of all the English monarchs from the conquest onwards and their dates. If I'm having difficulty sleeping, I still, you know, repeat those to myself.
So after a year of getting yourself used to this thing, you were very happy there, were you, at the school?
I pretty much was, yes. I sort of felt quite, you know, okay, I understand this. And it was also a way of getting a lot more structure in my life than I had been. You know, I knew what time we got up, what we did. You had a wash, you got dressed, you went to breakfast, then you came back, then you made your bed. Then you went down to the front and you waited for the coach to pick you up. You got on the coach and you went to school and you had a timetable and it was actually dependable, because my life at home sort of wasn't terribly dependable. And there was just this general assumption that nothing was ever going to work properly and nothing was ever going to sort of, you were not... I mean, whenever we tried to catch a train with my mother, there was always this uncertainty about where the train was and if this was the right train and asking several people just to be sure. And it was just nice that at school, you just simply consulted this thing and said, right, so I've got double French now in that room. And in fact, you went there and it was the right room and you did in fact have double French.
Now, you'll not be surprised to hear that school days are something that come up again and again on My Time Capsule. Everybody's story is different, of course. Some delightful and funny, others not so great. Here's the stand-up comedian, Hal Cruttendon.
I think the school from the age of 5 to 8 was one of the nastiest experiences of my life. And I think it was only when my own kids went to school that I went, oh my God, it can be lovely. I went to this pre-prep school in West London that just seemed to hate kids. There were so many teachers there. Whenever I hear stories about people who went to boarding schools, now, obviously, they went a bit older, but I know people who went at 7 and stuff. Now, I was going home every evening, but some of the most unkind experiences of my life, from there was a teacher there when I was 5 and 6 that just hated little boys. And they were turning us into little men. We all had our uniforms. We were doing Latin at 6 and 7. There was just a cruelty to it. And I don't know. I want to say there are a few people I've met since then who were very good. Well, a very good friend of mine at the time who I hadn't seen for years, I met recently. And he went, oh, was it that bad? And I went, oh, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm overreacting. But I remember, I mean, there was one teacher there that really would have been prosecuted now. I was 5. I was in her class. And this is where I mustn't cry. I was so scared. Get this one out of the way first. I was so scared. I needed the loo and I was so scared I didn't put my hand up and I wet myself. And I was not a kid that wet myself. And she made the rest of the class laugh at me.
Oh, Lord.
And you look back and go, oh, my word, that was... It was astonishing abuse. There was, I mean, psychological abuse. There was a boy there and I can't believe this happened, but I know it did. He was playing football and he got injured and she wouldn't let him stop playing. And he never stopped limping.
Oh, no.
I mean, it sounds cartoon-like. It sounds ridiculous. This one teacher, I think I saw her once when I was 15 in a supermarket and I was still terrified. I still nearly wet myself. No, she was just hated kids. Mm. And so many teachers were just horrible. You just felt like no one liked you. Mm. But out of that, there was one man. And it'd be lovely if his relatives heard this. I don't know anything about him. He will be long dead now. A lovely man called Mr. Scammell. Mm-hmm. And he just comes to mind to me recently because I realised that he was the one nice man in this school. He was always sweet. He was always nice to you. He didn't need to shout at us to control us. We were just nice. We were just kids.
Yeah, of course.
I remember Virginia Wade winning Wimbledon. And him running into every classroom going, boys, I've got to tell you, Virginia Wade's won Wimbledon. And he just liked kids. He was just a nice, sweet man. And there was a school trip when I was about 8 and just before I left, I must have been 7 or 8, we went on a week-long trip to Dieppe. And
wow.
I was incredibly young, but there were 3 of us who were like 8.
Yeah.
And we were like the babies of this group because it was pre-prep, 5 till 8, and then there were boys that stayed there till they were 13.
Yeah.
So it was the whole school, whoever wanted to go, went on this week-long trip to Dieppe where we stayed in a house where we boarded in a French school and we just ran around Dieppe and did stuff and it was just... And Mr. Scammell's one of the teachers on this trip. I think it was because he was taking it. I went, well, I'll go if Mr. Scammell's taking it.
Yeah.
And I look back on that. I was the youngest person on the trip. And when I look back, I remember coming, and for years, I didn't realise this. And I used to go, that was so great, that trip. And I won everything. I won every competition. I won this and that and that. And he must have said to other boys, you know, a bit worried about the kids, but, you know, he got the sort of 11, 12, 13-year-olds go, just be nice, you know. And I won everything.
The thing that excites me about recording my time capsule is not knowing what my guest is going to talk about. Everybody makes me laugh most of the time, but occasionally a story is so touching you can't help but cry a bit. The actress Caroline Quintin, talking about the birth of her children, was one such lovely moment.
Okay, the next thing I'm going to put into the time capsule is, again, it's a moment in time. It's a moment in time. Well, it's sort of two. I don't know if it's cheating. Anyway, I'm going to do it. But so I've got, I have two children, and there was a moment with each of them, and with both of my children, that they were both quite difficult births. My daughter came 10 weeks early. So I was filming a series called Jonathan Creek, and I'd been filming all day. And I'm laughing now. I wasn't laughing 21 years ago. I got out of a car in the middle of Soho, where I was living at the time. I'd been filming in Derby, and my waters broke. I hadn't got to the end of the book, because obviously I wasn't expecting her for 10 weeks, so I hadn't actually finished reading the what happens next. Yeah, literally, I thought I'd wet myself. I didn't know what had happened. So I phoned Sam, my husband, who was around the corner working, and I said, I'm not sure. I don't know whether I've wet myself or something's going on, you know. But it was 10 weeks. It's a lot early. I mean, it's very early for a baby. Anyway, long story short, my daughter arrived the following day by emergency cesarean. And she was tiny, tiny baby. She was about 2.5 pounds. She was tiny. Because I was hopeless. I mean, I'd been working and, you know, I'd sort of reading a bit about pregnancy, but rather loving it all and being a bit excited. And I had a dog and I thought it'd be similar to that. And it wasn't. But the moment I'd like to put in really is the moment when they handed me my daughter. I wasn't allowed to keep her for very long. She had to go into an incubator very, very quickly. It was the first time I was allowed to hold her for more than a couple of seconds, which was probably a couple of weeks in, actually. So she'd been in the incubator, but eventually they handed me my baby. And she looked at me, Michael, obviously, if you knew her now. She looked at me and I swear to God, it was like, oh, my God, it's you. Oh, hi. Yeah. And she went, oh, it's you. And I went, oh, hi, it's you. And it was like, oh, you're here. It was as if all my life, it was like all my life I'd been waiting for her. It was the most wonderful thing. It was like I just waited for her to come. And she looked at me and was like, oh, thank God you're here. Thank God you're here. Thank God you're here. You're here. Thank God. It's like I've been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for her.
Oh, isn't that beautiful? Matthew Kelly talked about the birth of a child, his grandchild, when I spoke to him in his dressing room at the Theatre Royal Brighton. But he took the opportunity to mention one or two other people as well.
We're allowed to name drop in this, aren't we?
As much as you like.
Oh, because I'm going two legs. I was asked to do Waiting for Godot with Ian McKellen. Right? I know. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic. And we did it at the Haymarket Theatre, and then we toured in Australia and New Zealand and South Africa. Well, there are lots of very special things about that, because I had my 60th birthday in Melbourne. But for McKellen, we went to South Africa to play for no pay for a month to play the townships. And that was part of the deal, that at the end of the tour that we would go to the townships, which were a little bit scary because we went to a place that was called the Oliver Tambo Centre. And you know those signs that say no smoking? And it's like a red circle on a white background and a cigarette with a diagonal red line in it. Well, this place had one of those, and next to it, there was a gun on a circle with a line. And they said, whatever you do after the show, don't go to a Shabeen. Shabeen is a bar that sells very cheap liquor and usually has a wooden floor, and it's a bit of a cage. So we went, no, no, we're not going to do that because we all hit and went to a shebeen after it. It was just fantastic in the middle of this township. I mean, but the moment for me in Sydney, at Sydney Opera House, was my daughter was having her first child in Sydney. And I used to walk every day to the theatre, Sydney Opera House, and Sydney Harbour Bridge on the other side. My daughter's pregnant. She came at 9 months pregnant to see the show. And then one night, just towards the end of the run there, she went into labour. And we were, me and Brendan O'Hay and Ian McKellen and Roger Rees were taking our bows at the end of the show, and they all knew that she was very near the time. And as we were taking the bows, we all bowed, and the boys turned to each other and went, any news yet? And I went, no, nothing yet. She's still in labour. And actually, he was born while we were taking the bows.
Wow.
And we didn't know. And actually, it was my anniversary in showbiz, June the 24th, and that's why I've never forgot that. Yeah. William was born.
And with the sound of applause ringing in your ears.
Yeah, exactly.
How wonderful.
I know.
Okay, who'd like to hear the brilliant Lee Mack talking about the thing he'd like to bury in the ground? And actually, it turns out to be quite appropriate for something you'd want to bury.
Well, the final item I want to put in, the item that you told me I could bury, never to come out again, because I'm not a fan of it, I wanted to put in gardening, particularly vegetable growing.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really, really trying to do the right thing with vegetable growing. I mean, it's so good for the environment if you do it, if you grow it yourself. So good for you, for all sorts of benefits to grow your own vegetables and fruit. But the unless you really know what you're doing, unless you put the time and effort in, the crop you get is piss poor, and I'm really annoyed. See, I did pumpkins for the first time. Yeah. The idea being, if I grow 3 pumpkins, each one of my children can carve it at Halloween. I mean, what a lovely, lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
That's the dream. The reality is not the same. The reality is you go out there. I didn't know pumpkins, I don't know if you've ever grown pumpkins, they're Jurassic. They go everywhere.
They are, yes.
I mean, they've taken over every bit of space I've got down there. I don't know enough about them to know what I can chop back. The stems are like needles. You can't touch them. They're so sharp. I don't know. I can't even find where it starts. I mean, which bits are needed, which bits going to cut back. I've tried looking online, but I just...
Are there any pumpkins on it? Or is it just this triffid?
That is the one thing that is growing, because there are pumpkins there. But it's put a lot of time and effort. And back in the day, cooking and gardening wasn't a lifestyle choice. It was a necessity. You know, people who didn't have much money had to grow their own vegetables. And I go, but how did they do it economically? Because I must have spent about, I'm not exaggerating, £200 on these 4 pumpkins. If you add up the bed that I had to make, I had to put wood around the bed, I had to put certain fertilizers in. And when you go to the shop and see that they're £2.50, it breaks your heart. You go,
yes.
I mean, when I now go to the supermarket, I'm supposed to go, ha, away with your mass-produced nonsense. But I don't. I go, look at those onions. Mine are like, my carrots are the size of my thumb and they're all wrinkly. These carrots, people will say you can taste the difference. There is some truth, you can taste the difference if they grow well. But if they don't grow well, you can taste the difference in the wrong way, because you're biting into it and just going, oh, that tastes a bit softer than it should have been.
These are shit.
So I'm doing all the right things, but without the rewards. And I've had enough. Turning your compost. Have you ever done that? Ever turned compost?
I have, yes.
They very casually say that, don't they, online? The thing about compost is just to remember to turn it every week. Turn it every week. I went out there to turn my compost. I am not exaggerating to say I was out there for 10 hours turning that compost. It took so long to get it out, and then I had to put it all back in again. And I'm supposed to do that every week.
Yeah.
You know, you can see why people turn up at garden centres. And compost, another example. Compost, I mean, I don't want mass-produced compost. I'm sure it's terrible for the environment. You open a new packet of compost, you can almost eat it. It's beautiful. My compost is full of twigs, and it's not breaking down. It's been there for 2 years. I'm turning it. It's back-breaking. I want some rewards. Come on.
It is true. There are very few things that you can actually grow if you're trying to grow vegetables, unless you're really good at it. And I've grown a lot of vegetables in my time. I had an allotment for many years, but I discovered there were about 3 or 4 things that I grew very easily. Potatoes?
I'll stop you there, Mike. I'll stop you there.
Okay.
That's what somebody said to me. That's exactly what I did. And they're not growing. Now, you think Last year, brilliant. This year, nothing. Now, admittedly, I did put them in, I tried to grow them in bags, and I fill that bag with mushroom compost. They don't grow in mushroom compost. So now I've been left with, I'm not exaggerating, every potato is about the size of a marble, and I refuse to throw them away, and I've attempted to peel them. Because you can't, and so you peel it and you are left with, I can only describe it as, I mean, it's not even a mouthful. I mean, it's not even a bite. There's nothing on this potato. And I've got thousands of them, tiny little marbled potatoes. And I just, like you say, they should be easy to grow. Spuds didn't work. Tomatoes, very upsetting for me. And I hate myself. I hate myself. All I wanted was to grow. I grew everything for one stew. If I put all these ingredients in a pot and I can just say to the kids, I grew everything in that pot. And we did have that meal and it was like Christmas Day at Tenko. Do you remember Tenko, that TV show? It was like a small ration of like one tomato, five marbled potatoes. It was just terrible. It was like, was that it? The worst one I did was the grow bags for tomatoes. I saw them and it says, tomato grow bags. I bought four of them. I slit the top, so now the soil is exposed. I watered it and I left it. And I left it for about 2 months. And every day I watered it until someone pointed out, you have to still put tomato plants in it. I thought it was within the soil. It said tomato grow bags. So I took off the things and just waited for them to grow. And someone said, no, they're just a bag of compost is all they are. You're supposed to plant them. And I thought the seeds would start sprouting through and it'd be lovely and it was just, you know, it'd be instant. I mean, I should have just read the back, but to be fair, they didn't, at no point on the back did they say, make sure you add to, I think they just, it was a given that people would know. Because they said tomato grow bags, I've seen the word tomato in grow and I'm thinking, it's all in the bag, tomato grow bag.
The wonderfully funny Lee Mack there. What an idiot. Now, a number of guests have understandably chosen either social media or mobile phones as the bane of their life, the thing they want to bury and forget. But the comedian Mark Watson had a different perspective.
My life had reached a point where I could, on the day of my 40th birthday, look around and say, "This, you know, I'm very broadly speaking, very happy with everything."
Yeah.
And so I was thinking this morning when I thought about doing this, I thought, you know, how can I encapsulate? Because what I basically want to take is that night and put that in the capsule.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, not only are there photos of it on my phone, but the phone numbers of those loved ones are on my phone. There are messages relating to the birthday on there. and also the music that I play, all of it. And it's easy to forget how much of your life is contained within your phone.
Mm.
But in a way, if you have a smartphone, it itself is a mini. You're walking around with a time capsule, basically. So I feel like most of us would not want people to take our phone in the future and examine the contents for all sorts of reasons. You know, it's very personal having that much of your brain stored in one place.
Mm.
But I do think, because, you know, I've already said that I love the permanence of an old program or, you know, a medal. So I am quite old-fashioned in some ways. But also I do think it's extraordinary and exciting that you can carry something around that's, well, I'm holding it up, but this is audio. Anyway, you can all picture a phone.
Yeah.
Something the size of a phone can contain as much information about us as it can is an amazing thing, which no humans have ever had that until.
No, and the things you don't quite realize at the time. I mean, I basically got an app that was there to record my mileage when I was driving.
Yeah.
And then I realized after a while this was logging everywhere I'd been, really precisely.
That's right.
I mean, every street I'd been to, all those women I'm having an affair with.
Yes, that's difficult to pull off an affair if you don't want your phone to know about it, isn't it? That's the thing. Once again, it's this thing about what we want to leave behind or what we want to project versus what we actually are leaving. It's interesting, isn't it? Your phone knows lots about you, which you're not even aware it knows.
Yeah.
You can see this when it starts to do predictive texting and stuff, and it often quite accurately forecasts what might be on your mind. And I always find that quite unnerving because, again, it makes you wonder how much it's listening to you. And I think, you know, a lot of people talk about the sinister aspects of this, about the fact that our phones are potentially being used to harvest data and monitor us in ways we're not comfortable with. And that's probably all true.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, on another level, your phone is a fascinating companion to you in a way. It knows where you, what you're up to. It peculiarly, it sort of understands your thought processes to some extent, however artificially. So even though all of us have a mixed relationship with our phones, a bittersweet relationship with the phones, we perhaps all wish we didn't have to be tied to the gadgets so much, all that, I do think sometimes it's worth stopping and thinking about the positives, which are that everybody that has one of these tiny devices has more of themselves assembled in one easy-to-find place than any... I can never get past the thought that, that this has never happened before, that only people living post about 2000 have had this privilege.
Well, we're running out of time, sadly, so let's get straight to another of my guests, the writer and actor and star of The Far Show, Charlie Higson.
I got to know both Harry Enfield and Vic Reeves through friends at university. They weren't at university with me, but I had friends of theirs at university and had known them over the years. And I'd worked alongside them both, working with Harry, obviously, on his early stuff, and also working with Vic and Bob, doing bits of performing with them. And then when they did Smell of Reason Mortimer, I was one of the producers on that. And I also was an advisor when they started doing Shooting Stars. And so our careers were sort of went in parallel. And then, you know, Shooting Stars really took off. And the big difference, I think, with the way that Vic and Bob approach things and the way that Paul and I approach things is Vic and Bob love winging it. They love having ideas and trying to keep it fresh and as spontaneous as they can, planning things but not over-planning it. Paul and I are incredibly meticulous. We work out every detail. And because Paul and I ended up producing everything we did, we were also all used to being kind of in charge, and I particularly am very anal about things. So we have a completely different approach to things. So Vic and Bob came to us one day and said, I'll do a terrible accent, which is a sort of amalgamation of the two of them. Said, oh, Charlie, you know, we'd really like to do some live stuff with Shooting Stars, but we realise it can't really sustain a whole evening's entertainment. And people will see through it and get quite cross. They said, how about we do a joint show? We do Shooting Stars in one half. I'm losing the accent now. Forget the accent. Half of it will be Shooting Stars and half will be The Fast Show. And we thought, well, this is fantastic because it means that we only need to put together an hour and they only need to put together an hour. And something like The Fast Show, it is kind of quick and you don't want to stay around for too long. And we thought, you know, we could put together a really, really strong hour-long show and we'll do a joint show. And we did. And Phil McIntyre got involved and said, you know, yes, this will work. Guaranteed a very nice amount of money for us all. And Vic and Bob said, we'll do the first half. We'll get ours out of the way because it's going to be a mess. And then we can go and get drunk. Because they set up in the car park behind the Apollo. They set up this kind of big temporary nightclub area, basically, with a big free bar. And they'd have bands playing and things in there. So after the show, there would always be a big party. But Jim and Bob would always get in there at half time. So by the time we came off, they were fairly merry. And, you know, their half of the show was a complete mess. I mean, it was great fun. They did all the stuff you wanted to see. Mm. And it was ramshackle. It cost them nothing to put on. But ours, we had hundreds of costume and makeup people and wigs and costumes and quick change areas and huge great sets and and music. So, of course, we spent a lot more money on our bit than they did. But it was fantastic fun to do that. And we actually sold out 32 nights at the Apollo.
Our penultimate guest is the delightful actor and writer Tony Hawks. But I bet you didn't know just how delightful he really is. You will after this, although he simply sees himself as selfish.
The nice thing about the things that I've done with, say, Round Island with a Fridge, playing the Moldovans at tennis, and in fact also the third book, which was called One Hit Wonderland, that had an extraordinary story of me going to Albania with Norman Wisdom.
Yes.
But the nice thing about those things is they are kind of timeless stories because it's not a less interesting story because it happened 20 years ago.
No.
It's, in fact, in some cases, a little bit more interesting because, especially in the case of Albania, you know, the country's changed dramatically since then, and so has Moldova, what have you.
But you've also done work in Moldova, haven't you?
Yes.
You've got a charity there, haven't you?
Yes, well, I set up a care centre there for kids with cerebral palsy, which... So that was kind of because when I was there, I'd never seen so much poverty, really.
No.
It was and still is the poorest country in Europe. And I was thinking, well, look, I'm here trying to win this very silly bet, but I'm going to go back and write a book for which I've got an advance, and I'm using this country, really, for raw material. I owe it something. So for my own sake, really, I went, well, I'll just make a deal. I'll put 50% of whatever I earn into a fund and we'll give it back to Moldova. So there was enough at some point to do something when I rang the two doctors I'd stayed with and said, look, we've got, you know, this amount of money. What could we do in this country? Mm. And they said, well, what happens is, you know, we hate seeing it, but we see all the state encouraging people to have a child with cerebral palsy or any disability to give them up and put them into these so-called orphanages or homes where they were treated and abused. We'd like to set up a centre where, you know, we can treat people. They come in every now and again for sort of 2 weeks of treatment, then go away. We show them how to do the treatment and they can stay at home. And so that's been going about sort of, I don't know how long, it can't be far off 20 years now.
No.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, my attitude to it is actually that it's enlightened selfishness. So I think, you know, I go there, you know, pretty much every year, and you sort of get mothers that sort of throw themselves at you, not in that way, unfortunately, just so grateful to you and hug you and tell you about what they've gone through. And you're rather touched by it. But I think what you do is you come away definitely feeling better about yourself. You're able to say, you know, I'm an okay bloke, you know, whatever else happens, I'm an okay bloke. And I do that for me. I don't do it for them, actually. You know, I mean, so I think if you can get that into people's heads, that's when you see a very different world.
That altruism is fundamentally selfish.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it is.
Yeah.
And it's been proven to be that, in fact, you know, that you get more different oxytocin, various chemicals flow to your brain when you give and you do something generous. So why are you seeking a yacht? Mm. Why are you seeking something that actually doesn't do that? And that's not really on the table enough as an argument, because if you teach children that and they genuinely recognise it as being good for themselves, because I think we are fundamentally selfish. You know, we've got to look after ourselves. I do. You know, I know I'm not a good person. I know I make sure I've got enough first. Absolutely. Yeah. I think you need some sort of deep religious conviction in order to be able to really suffer ahead of someone else. You've got to possibly to believe, even that you could argue is selfish, because you could say, well, what you're doing there is you think you're going to get your reward in the next life. So even in that situation, you're going, we're still hardwired to put ourselves first. So what you do is you just say, well, look, I recognise that it doesn't serve me to get more and more stuff, but it does serve me to go, well, you know, I've got enough, I've made sure I've got enough. So this bit, I'm going to do this with it. There's been quite a bit of research into the super rich give less money on a kind of percentage scale than poor people do, because what they have to do is look away much more, because otherwise that rather painful guilt thing kicks in.
Yeah.
So I think what happens is people get more and more, and then they don't want to be confronted with the injustice of how things are. So the only way they can sort of get through is by kind of pushing it at blank, you know, putting it out. And then maybe making some big gesture at a charity auction, mm-hmm, where everybody thinks how wonderful they are.
Yes.
It's that kind of thing.
Well, sadly, we've reached our final, final guest. And as with part one and two of these compilation episodes, I'm going to leave you with the master. Here are some of my favourite anecdotes and jokes from the great Barry Cryer.
Oh, Tom O'Connor's story. Tom said, I'm dying in a club one night. Every joke, every line, I'm sweating, I'm humiliated, I want to get off. And he said, I did one joke, and at the back of the club, I heard,
And he said very sarcastically, I said, thank you, sir. And the man said I was smacking the sauce bottle. Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, that is brilliant.
Les Dawson in the sweating early days playing the back room of a pub. He said, I'm dying. He said, I paused at one point and a voice at the back of the room said, used to be a pool table in here. Roger Kitter, the late, bless him, the actor, went into Bloom's restaurant years ago with Larry Adler. And they were waiting for their table and Larry looked round and said, I came in here 40 years ago with cold porter. God. And the man behind the desk said, we're serving as fast as we can. And I was going outside Morrison's to have a cigarette. Young mother with two young children. And I said, I'm not smoking near your children. She said, thank you very much. And I walked away. And she lit up. Guy smoking a cigarette outside a pub. And an officious bugger came up and said, can't you see that sign? You can't smoke within 6 feet of the pub. He said, I'm drinking to the one up the road. Saturday morning, live. Elaine stretches on it and she told an anecdote. And she finished the anecdote and said, so I said to him, what the fuck are you talking about? And she said, sorry, Ned, could I do that again? He said, this is live, darling. She said, oh, shit. Brilliant. My little party piece, if I'm ever asked, is my old man's a dustman to the tune of Heartbreak Hotel.
That's is that your favourite one?
That's my little party piece.
Is that your song to a different...
My old man's a dustman. He wears a dustman's hat. He wears gold blimey trousers and he lives in a castle. I was with Russ Abbott, I think, at the time or something. And not much happening in the afternoon. And Jimmy Perry, an old friend, said, Baz, what are you doing? I said, not a lot. He said, it's the last Dad's Army today. And he said, you know them all, pop in. And my timing, I couldn't believe it. It was a tea break or something. And I walked in. Hello, hello. No. Arthur Lowe came over to me. Hello, Barry. Oh, boy. Sad day, isn't it, really? It's an institution, this show, a tradition. I said, Arthur, you've had a bloody good run with it. I know, but it's, oh, forgive me, a bit sad. And he walked away, and John Laurie came over to me and said, what's the old cunt been saying to you?
You have been listening to The Best of My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and some of the people I've been lucky enough to chat with during 2021. I hope you had fun and that it encourages you to listen to the full episodes that are available to stream or download on Acast or your own favourite podcast provider. Perhaps you may even want to subscribe. If you do, please rate the show and maybe write a review. You can follow me or My Time Capsule on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. The theme tune is by Pass the Peas Music and is available on Spotify, and this was a cast-off production. The producer was John Fenton Stevens. I'll be back in 2022 with loads more guests. But until then, should old acquaintance be... What is the next word? Oh, well, never mind. Happy New Year. Bye. Forgot. That was... Ah, idiot.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.